You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show right here on WEAA, and I'm joined now by a stand-up comic who is coming to the Creative Alliance in Baltimore this weekend, Jorge Candabuli, who is just one of the funniest men I've heard. Debut album called Waiting for 2042. And Jorge, good to have you on the show. Welcome, man. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
So why are you waiting for 2042?
2042 is the year when, according to census figures, white people will be the minority in the United States. And I'm waiting for it. So the title is kind of ironic, only just because in the actual album I talk about how, like, it's not actually me who's waiting, but it seems to be a lot of people in this country who are waiting and worried about that year, or whenever this number shifts, getting freaked out about what's going to happen. Like, oh, will our culture change or a language change? And it's this kind of this fear mongering that the mainstream media also kind of perpetuates. And I feel like, you know, race is a construct. Racism is real, but the actual idea of race is a construct. The idea that we're separated by this idea of race is absurd. So, you know, that's kind of what I lay out in the album. But, you know, that was a lot to write for an album title, so I just kind of kept it to waiting for 2042. Decided not to Fiona Apple it on my first album.
So. Right, exactly. And album, is that a name? Do people still say album? I guess they do still say album, don't they?
Well, I mean, it depends, I think, on how you see it. I mean, I definitely made this with the idea of it being an album, like something right. That actually flowed from beginning to end, and not like a... I didn't want it just to be a folder with MP3 files in it, which it also is, but, like, you know, I wanted something that had, like, a vision that connected things together, that had album art connected to it, so it was a full thing. Like, I wanted it to be something like I'd heard when, you know, growing up listening to comedy albums that actually flowed together and had callbacks and made sense and had a clear point of view. So, yeah, I'm definitely invested in the album concept.
So who, Hurry, when you were growing up, were the people that grabbed you as comedians?
I mean, the first comic that really made me want to do stand-up was Margaret Cho.
Uh-huh.
She had a special, I think, on HBO that Comedy Central used to re-air all the time, and Comedy Central had like four programs. And I remember watching her special a ton of times and just being inspired by the fact that she wasn't black, white, or Latino. And so it was like, this is somebody who was talking about their immigrant family and about their experiences growing up in San Francisco. And none of this was weird. It was like, not only was it loved by the audience that was there, but it was being broadcast. And I saw that, and it made me want to do stand-up. And that's kind of what made me start. I think the comic who had the most profound impact after that was Paul Mooney, who I saw perform in Washington, D.C., probably 2002 or 2003. Like, Mooney wrote for Pryor. Mooney wrote for Living Color. Like, he's an incredible stand-up comic, very aggressive with regards to race and his experiences with race. And the idea that he was in Washington, D.C., making so many people uncomfortable, so many white people uncomfortable, and actually walking out of shows. And yet the people that stayed because they loved him, because they understood what he was saying, because what he was saying was cathartic to them and hilarious. And so, that for me allowed me to see that the boundaries could be stretched in terms of what you can say and how aggressive you can be, and you don't need to pander and still be funny. And then I saw a comedian a few years ago in the UK called Stuart Lee, who is probably, you know, my most recent inspiration. Yeah, he's incredible. He's just... he does lots of long-form things. He plays with the form of stand-up. They won't be simple setup and punchline kinds of jokes. There'll be a lot of, like, thematic things. And he, for me, the way Mooney stretched what you could do in terms of discomfort with material, I think Stuart Lee does that in addition to what you can do in terms of shaking up the form so people don't expect what you're going to do, because the actual way a joke is delivered is going to look very different. So, I mean, those are probably the big ones for me in terms of impact. And in terms of shaping my thought, like, definitely those three.
In some ways, you do that. I mean, in the work I've seen you do on YouTube and stuff I've been watching that you do. I mean, because you set people up with this really interesting conversation about the reality of something and then hit them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that has to do with over-education, if anything. I think I just feel like I have to lecture, like, for about a minute. I believe it's called a setup in the comedy industry. But, like, I feel like there's a minute of explaining a thing and then giving the joke. Because I feel like the idea is it's something that everyone can relate to and understand. But to me, it's like some of the stuff I think people can relate to, but they just haven't had some information that would, like, explain the bigger idea. And once they get that, they'll get the joke. Or sometimes when the joke doesn't work, I like to write an explanation of the joke, which becomes the new punchline, which people tell you you're not supposed to explain the joke. But that, to me, like, I love explaining the joke. I think there's something really funny in that moment of, like, you know, I think it's great. You're not laughing, but I'll explain why it's funny. Like, to me, there's another opportunity for a punchline. So, yeah, I'm a little, as you can hear right now, I'm a little rambly. I explain a lot of things.
Yeah.
Talk a lot before I get to the point. But that's stylistic, you know.
All right, that's
definitely a choice.
Exactly. I mean, when you said overeducated, that I read that you got your master's degree in human rights at London School of Economics. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I used to be an immigrant rights organizer and
uh-huh.
I did comedy at night, and I got discovered in Seattle doing comedy when I had this incredible job as an organizer. And I always wanted to do comedy professionally, but I never thought it was really open to me. I didn't think people would really be interested in what I had to say. But I wanted to go to grad school, so I went to LSE, and comedy was still there waiting for me when I got back. And, you know, I don't, like, regret any of the educational choices. I think
right.
it's made me a fuller person, but certainly, like, I'm not using the degree in any practical way at this point. So.
That's okay.
But to be fair, comedy is as lucrative as human rights, so I'm not making much either way.
So, yeah. So, I mean, why do you think people are all crazy about? I mean, I'm serious. I saw your pieces on 2042, but we are crazy about race in this country. We just have a hard time dealing with it, talking about it, thinking about it. People are terrified of it.
I mean, I think it's a lot of things. I think part of it is people aren't educated in how to and talk about it. It's not like we have a shared set of ideas, right? Like, you know, certain things I believe, like just like Columbus is not a hero. This country was built on slavery and genocide. To me, those are facts. I feel like, and I think they're the facts that can be proven because those things are true. Like, there used to be people who lived on this land who now have been, you know, portioned off into little areas. Like, it's not, you know, to me, these are things that if we at least agree to some of the basic things, at least from there, we can be less uncomfortable about seeing what the country actually is, you know. Not to say you can't have pride in how you grew up or what you are and who you are, but at the same time, it's like, let's at least address some of the basics and then from there talk about, you know, what we can actually do to improve individual relations. We're just so far apart. There's such a disconnect. I mean, that's one great thing about comedy is, like, even though I know those disconnects are there, like, people will give me the benefit of the doubt. They'll cut me some slack because I'm a comic, so I can talk about these things, and they'll listen because they know there's a joke coming, or there better be a joke coming. So, I mean, which I found out when the jokes don't hit, like, it's really just a lecture or slam poetry, which is exactly what I don't want to do. So I think that, like, people just don't have the language. They're afraid also of, like, what if I offend somebody, which I understand, you know, but at the same time, I think if we actually were able to have these conversations at a younger age, you know, early on, and actually, like, break through some of that stuff, you know, where we, like, self-segregate and all that, if we actually knew how to communicate with each other from our really younger years, that would help. And also, I think diversity is important on a basic level because then no one's really a stranger. I grew up in Queens, New York. I grew up with everybody in the world. You know, so for me,
wow,
I can communicate and be friends with a lot of different people because I know how it is from early on. Nothing really freaks me out. Like, this person's from here. This person looks like none of that. Once you get past that, the basic level of just communicating is easier.
You know, the Queens is a wild place. I mean, I've read the Queens. I remember doing a story with somebody there. Queens is the one place on the planet Earth that has somebody who lives there from almost every corner of the earth,
yeah.
every nation on the planet. Any food you want, you can get in Queens.
Yeah. And it's incredible to be, Mark, because to me, it's so wonderful and magical, and I can't believe I grew up there. And yet, this is what rest of the country fears. They fear Queens.
They fear
the country turning into Queens.
Right.
And as someone who is from Queens, grew up in Queens, who is the product of Queens, you have nothing to fear. The food will be better. You'll have so much more culture. You don't need to travel as much because the world comes to you. Like, I don't understand this ridiculous fear. It's absurd. Like, people are afraid of Queens, and there's no reason to be afraid of Queens.
But you ended up in Seattle.
Yeah, because, you know, I have friends out in Seattle looking for a job, I moved out there to be an immigrant rights organizer. I got a position at a nonprofit there, and it was great, you know, and it's still one of my favorite cities. It's a city that I hold close and I travel to work on new material. I still have a lot of friends there who are organizers and social workers and who I draw a lot of ideas from and strength from. So, you know, certainly, like, it's a little hidden thing for me where I can, you know, I'm in Seattle right now. I went to, Seattle for the summer just to work out stuff.
But you live on the East Coast.
Yeah. I normally live in New York City, in Brooklyn.
So I was thinking about going back to Queens. It really is a kind of a place where you can go anywhere. I can remember going to a restaurant. I was starving and just walked into a place, and it was run by Bokharan Jews. Where else are you going to run to a Bokharan Jew but Queens?
Right. Randomly. It's not like you were looking for it. You just stumbled into it, because that's the thing you can stumble into in Queens. And it's not like a separate neighborhood either. Sometimes you just walk into a place and I'm like, oh, all right. This is. I'm in another place. Like, it's pretty exceptional. Like, even like the most bizarre, like having a haircut with a barber from Eastern Europe, and then all of a sudden he knows all this stuff about Bollywood, because during the Cold War they didn't get U.S. pictures, right? They didn't get films from the West, so they could only get them from Bollywood in terms of a big commercial industry. So there's all these folks from Russia and Eastern Europe who know Bollywood films before, communism ended. That's the specialty from, like, the 60s to, like, the late 80s. They have this incredible catalog of Bollywood film in their head. Like, where else am I going to have that interaction? Like, that's incredible.
I love it. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, it's true. It's one of my favorite places to go hang out and have friends there. So I love Queens. And so when people push you and say, well, why do you got to talk about race all the time?
I mean, it makes it sound as if, well, I talk about race all the time, first of all, because I'm sensitive. I think a lot of comics are the same way. They might hide it differently, but I think I'm very aware and sensitive to things that are around me. Race is something when you experience racism, when you always get colored by the way people look at you or what they say, when you get asked, where are you from? Or you get asked for ethnicity constantly by strangers. Like, you start to, like, wonder, like, you know, what is going on? Like, this is, it's not even starting to wonder. You're like, it's embedded from the early days of, like, growing up. You see how people view you once they understand that, like, there's a difference between different races and stuff, which there isn't, but that's what you're programmed to believe. So, to me, like, all this stuff is so easy for me to see. Like, I see racism quick. I see how it's hidden. Like, I've read enough, I've studied enough, I've experienced enough to know. So it's the same way where Jerry Seinfeld can talk about, like, any basic observation he sees and makes it funny. To me, racism is a basic observation. It's not hard for me to spot. It's something I can make interesting, and I do it extremely well because it's something that's part of my lens. It's part of my worldview. It's not something I have to search for. The same way that some people can, like, talk about dogs and cats and make that funny because that's their experience. To me, I see racism pretty quick. I see how it's hidden in messages. I see, you know, I can talk about history and like how it plays out. Like, that to me is easy to do, and it's fun to do. And I think it's, like, important. Like, I think it's important to talk about these things. I do it because I think it's funny, but certainly, like, you know, I know that people have other conversations after they see my act, which always feels good.
Yeah, you had this one. I remember one of the pieces I watched that you did where you said something about when people ask why you talk about race so much, it's something about, well, talking about race in America is something like trying to swim while you're drowning.
Yeah. Like, saying that I'm obsessed with racism in America is like saying I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning.
Right.
Right. Which, it's so funny to me, Mark, because that was initially just a setup for the bigger joke. But then I saw them protest signs, like that quotation, around the country, in Baltimore, in New York, all over the country where there were protests, Black Lives Matter protests, just anti-police brutality protests. I saw that quote, and it's a funny thing because when you're a comic, you don't see you don't expect your stuff to be used at rallies. You know what I mean? Like, you expect the music to be used. But, like, to me, it's like I felt really great about it, but it was hard to explain to my peers why this was happening, like why my joke is on protest signs. Because the rest of the comics are like, are you trying to get on the Tonight Show? Yeah, but right now I'm on a protest sign. So I'm going to focus on being on a protest sign. So, yeah, it's a unique experience, and I'm glad that something like that resonates with people. And it really does. I think a lot of us feel that way, that we're being pulled under and we're desperately trying to stay afloat. And then meanwhile, people are yelling at us, stop trying to stay afloat. Why are you so obsessed with trying to survive? It's like, yeah.
Well, I think it's important what you bring out there, because, I mean, it means that you're before you got to Baltimore, your quote was on a sign, which is good.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a beautiful thing, and it's certainly, you know, I mean, it's hard because I think when people read it, I don't think they read it funny. When I said it, it got people to laugh, but, like, definitely when they read it on a sign, like, you know, they're not laughing. They're like, oh, my God, you know, which is weird because there's a high school poet in me who still is like, finally, the poetry I've always wanted to write is coming out in comedy. But it's, you know, it's pretty exceptional. I'm excited about these Baltimore shows. I'm excited to see who turns out. And I feel like, you know, I've played D.C. enough times, but I know Baltimore is very different. The energy is different.
It's a different place.
I imagine the crowds will be different, and
yes.
I'm excited about that. Like, I've just heard so much about Charm City, and it's time for me to do these shows.
And Creative Lines always gets where you'll be playing the Sunday. It always gets a good crowd, and an interesting mixed crowd usually. So it's a racially mixed crowd, so it should be really a good night for you there, I think. A really good night.
That's always my ideal situation, too, when you get the most diverse audience possible. I think it puts people at ease. You know, because then you can see, and also you can see how different people react to different things and laugh at different things. And I think that's important. Like, when you have a lot of people of color, especially, I think there's sometimes white folks who get the jokes, but they feel uncomfortable laughing because they're not sure if they're allowed to. And then when you have enough diversity, people of color in the room, all of a sudden certain jokes are getting laughed at, and they start to realize, no, that's okay to laugh at. And also, wow, I didn't laugh at that, but they really laughed at it, so that must mean something to them. And I think that's important. It's another way of seeing other people's perspective by seeing what they laugh at. So I love when it's diverse. It's always the best show.
You know, some of the things you do here, and I think it's really also very important, because I think this whole question of race in America is moving this country right now the way it needs to be moved, and I think we're in a very powerful moment. And part of it is that for any of that, that laughing about it is important. I mean, I see you do things like bringing in immigrant rights and turning that into a joke, or whether it's, you know, as you say, racism, colonialism, whatever you bring into it, that you bring that in, but you bring it as you. I've noticed other comedians will try to do a fake accent. I've never seen you do that.
No, for me, it's just not. It's not interesting. First of all, it's not, like, from a technical standpoint to me, unless you're really good at the impression or it's accurate and has depth to it, it's just hacky and uninteresting. That's just from as an artistically. But as a person whose parents are immigrants, it's like, they've suffered enough. I don't need to add to that. Like, they've had enough of a difficult time dealing with having an accent, people questioning their intelligence. Like, I don't want to add to that. And I think my parents have such depth, and I want to, you know, one thing I'm going to definitely be talking about during the show is just how funny my mom is. And that's something I, you know, and it's not funny because her voice is funny. She's funny because she's funny. She's clever. And
that's where you get it from.
That's definitely where my mom is very funny. My father's unintentionally funny, but my my mother knows what she's doing and why things are funny. Sometimes my dad's funny just because he's telling a joke that he's butchering 10 times in a row and gives away the punchline and he laughs through it. And you're just like, how does a human like this exist? Why does he tell jokes this way? But my mom, it's just quick, like lightning, like sharp, quick. So, I mean, I definitely get a lot of that from her. So, that's something I'm excited to talk about. Like, my parents are funny. Now, my mom is funny. My mom makes me funny. My dad makes me anxious. They're different dynamics, but like.
But they can work together.
Both,
they can work together.
They work together.
They work together.
That creates a comic.
You,
being funny and being anxious creates a comic.
You created something I saw this morning I had not seen before. The piece you did put on YouTube where you were talking about the Redskins. Well, I said the word. I didn't want to say the word.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to say the word. But you do the logo for that Washington team, and you really take them on in a very funny way.
Yeah, I said that the way to keep that name, if you really want to keep that name, is change it from a disembodied indigenous man's head, which is already very strange, that's the logo, to a severely sunburned white person. And, you know, I know the joke has always been a potato, but I think that actually evens the score a little bit, doesn't it? Still a person, still, you still get a mascot. Somebody comes out painted red with the sun over them. I think it's hilarious.
Well, let me think of a time. When I go out to the res in Wyoming where some friends of mine live, and we go to hang out there and spend some time, and we come out of a sweat, and usually when we come out of the sweat, it's very hot in the sweat. So I get very red. Right.
Right.
The first time that happened, I walked out, and my friend Sean looked at me and goes, "Oh, whoa, you are the Israel red man. You're the red man."
I mean, I know that would never happen, but I wish they would change a little bit of that. I think that would at least.
It needs to change.
It's a compromise. Yeah, it needs, and it's funny because it's also like, that's the name for the Washington team. In Baltimore, it's the Ravens. Like, it's just Edgar Allan Poe. Like, that's something to me,
right.
That is so great. Like, a football team named after, a literary reference. Like, that's so incredible. And then on the other side, it's like, all right.
I know. Okay. I don't think they'll ever wake up. As long as they're making their money and nobody says no.
I mean, it's going to change. It's inevitable. It's inevitable. I mean, I just think about how much change has happened in the last decade, especially with images and symbolism, people standing up for themselves and saying how they feel. At a certain point, you know, for all the talk of political correctness, it's not political correctness. Sometimes it's just correctness.
Right.
This is a intrinsic wrong, or it's people who've never got to stand up for themselves or have their voices heard finally having their voices heard. That's not political correctness. That's what movements are. You know, I think it's easy to say, like, they want to change the name because it's politically correct, as if no one has rationale or reasoning to why they like or dislike things, as if people are just blindly feeling something versus actually having reasons that are thought out. So, I mean, that also bothers me when these debates happen. It feels so condescending, like we don't, like as if we haven't thought things through. And that's more insulting than anything else, I feel like. You're calling us all stupid when you say politically correct.
Well, this, folks, you can really enjoy and up close and personal at the Creative Alliance this Sunday. Hari Kondabolu will be at the Creative Alliance this Sunday. What time does the show start? 7?
We have a 7 and we have a 9:30. I think the 7 is sold out, but we should have a few tickets for the 7:30.
So that's very cool. It's sold out.
7 and the 9:30 at the door.
So 9:30.
We'll be at the,
just go.
We'll be at the door.
Be at the door. Go to thecreativelions.org and you can get the tickets right there. We'll also hit that on our website so you can see what's happening there. His album coming out is Waiting for 2042. And Hari, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
So catch him this Sunday night. Go to creativelions.org for more information. We have to take a very brief break here, but when we return, I'll be talking with Dr. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz about her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. It just came out in paperback, and we sat down on our second conversation. You don't want to miss it. She's a fascinating woman. And on the way to break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. We'll be right back.